This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. This reading is by Martin Clifton. The Vicar of Wakefield, a tale supposed to be written by himself, by Oliver Goldsmith. Advertisement. There are 100 faults in this thing, and 100 things might be said to prove them beauties. But it is needless. A book may be amusing with numerous errors, or it may be very dull without a single absurdity. The hero of this piece unites in himself the three greatest characters upon earth. He is a priest, an husbandman, and the father of a family. He is drawn as ready to teach and ready to obey, as simple in affluence and majestic in adversity. In this age of opulence and refinement, who can such a character please? Such as are fond of high life will turn with disdain from the simplicity of his country fireside. Such as mistake ribaldry for humour will find no wit in his harmless conversation. And such as have been taught to deride religion will laugh at one whose chief stores of comfort are drawn from futurity. Chapter 1. The description of the family of Wakefield, in which a kindred likeness prevails, as well of minds as of persons. I was ever of opinion that the honest man who married and brought up a large family did more service than he who continued single, and only talked of population. From this motive I had scarce taken orders a year before I began to think seriously of matrimony, and chose my wife as she did her wedding gown, not for a fine glossy surface, but such qualities as would wear well. To do her justice, she was a good-natured, notable woman, and as for breeding, there were few country ladies who could show more. She could read any English book without much spelling, but for pickling, preserving, and cookery, none could excel her. She prided herself also upon being an excellent contriver in housekeeping, though I could never find that we grew richer with all her contrivances. However, we loved each other tenderly, and our fondness increased as we grew old. There was, in fact, nothing that could make us angry with the world or each other. We had an elegant house, situated in a fine country, and a good neighbourhood. The year was spent in moral and rural amusements, in visiting our rich neighbours and relieving such as were poor. We had no revolutions to fear, nor fatigues to undergo. All our adventures were by the fireside, and all our migrations from the blue bed to the brown. As we lived near the road, we often had the traveller or stranger visit us to taste our gooseberry wine, for which we had great reputation. And I profess with the veracity of an historian that I never knew one of them find fault with it. Our cousins, too, even to the 40th remove, all remembered their affinity without any help from the Herald's office, and came very frequently to see us. Some of them did us no great honour by these claims of kindred, and we had the blind, the maimed, and the halt amongst the number. However, my wife always insisted that as they were the same flesh and blood, they should sit with us at the same table. So that if we had not very rich, we generally had very happy friends about us. For this remark will hold good through life. The poorer the guest, the better pleased he ever is with being treated. And as some men gaze with admiration at the colours of a tulip or the wing of a butterfly, so I was by nature an admirer of happy human faces. However, when any one of our relations was found to be a person of very bad character, a troublesome guest, or one we desired to get rid of, upon his leaving my house, I took care to lend him a riding coat, or a pair of boots, or sometimes an horse of small value, and I always had the satisfaction of finding he never came back to return them. By this the house was cleared of such as we did not like, but never was the family of Wakefield known to turn the traveller or the poor dependent out of doors. Thus we lived several years in a state of much happiness, not but that we sometimes had those little rubs which Providence sends to enhance the value of its favours. My orchard was often robbed by schoolboys, and my wife's custards plundered by the cats or the children. The squire would sometimes fall asleep in the most pathetic parts of my sermon, or his lady return my wife's civilities at church with a mutilated curtsy. But we soon got over the uneasiness caused by such accidents, and usually in 3 or 4 days began to wonder how they vexed us. My children, the offspring of temperance, as they were educated without softness, so they were at once well-formed and healthy. My sons, hardy and active, my daughters, beautiful and blooming. When I stood in the midst of the little circle, which promised to be the supports of my declining age, I could not avoid repeating the famous story of Count Ebensburg, who, in Henry II's progress through Germany, while other courtiers came with their treasures, brought his 32 children, and presented them to his sovereign as the most valuable offering he had to bestow. In this manner, though I had but 6, I considered them as a very valuable present made to my country, and consequently looked upon it as my debtor. Our eldest son was named George after his uncle, who left us £10,000. Our second child, a girl, I intended to call after her aunt Gristle, but my wife, who during her pregnancy had been reading romances, insisted upon her being called Olivia. In less than another year we had another daughter, and now I was determined that Gristle should be her name. But a rich relation taking a fancy to stand godmother, the girl was, by her directions, called Sophia, so that we had 2 romantic names in the family. But I solemnly protest I had no hand in it. Moses was our next, and after an interval of 12 years we had 2 sons more. It would be fruitless to deny my exultation when I saw my little ones about me, but the vanity and the satisfaction of my wife were even greater than mine, when our visitors would say, "Well, upon my word, Mrs. Primrose, you have the finest children in the whole country." "Aye, neighbour," she would answer, "they are as heaven made them, handsome enough, if they be good enough, for handsome is that handsome does." And then she would bid the girls hold up their heads, who, to conceal nothing, were certainly very handsome. Mere outside is so very trifling a circumstance with me that I should scarce have remembered to mention it, had it not been a general topic of conversation in the country. Olivia, now about 18, had that luxuriancy of beauty with which painters generally draw Hebe, open, sprightly, and commanding. Sophia's features were not so striking at first, but often did more certain execution, for they were soft, modest, and alluring. The one vanquished by a single blow, the other by efforts successfully repeated. The temper of a woman is generally formed from the turn of her features, at least it was so with my daughters. Olivia wished for many lovers, Sophia to secure one. Olivia was often affected from too great a desire to please, Sophia even repressed excellence from her fears to offend. The one entertained me with her vivacity when I was gay, the other with her sense when I was serious. But these qualities were never carried to excess in either, and I have often seen them exchange characters for a whole day together. A suit of mourning has transformed my coquette into a prude, and a new set of ribbons has given her younger sister more than natural vivacity. My eldest son, George, was bred at Oxford, as I intended him for one of the learned professions. My second boy, Moses, whom I designed for business, received a sort of a miscellaneous education at home. But it is needless to attempt describing the particular characters of young people that had seen but very little of the world. In short, a family likeness prevailed through all, and, properly speaking, they had but one character, that of being equally generous, credulous, simple, and inoffensive. End of chapter.